in the beginning, if you could give me a sort of a 1 minute soundbite about who you are, what you guys have achieved, if you can talk about revenues, impact, you know, volume sold, whatever, that would be great. And the more detailed you can be, just to kind of show the sort of scale and volume that you've done.
Basically, I'll give you some quick background. The company, I mean, I've been at this company for 26 years. This is my second job at college. I was a film critic for my school paper, and I was an English major. I had no idea I was going to go into marketing. I certainly was a personable guy, but didn't know. I thought I'd be an editor, I'd be, you know, a writer or something. So I went to get a job in a publishing company, and the job that came available happened to be at this little company called Boardroom that published newsletters and books. And they happen to also have, you know, since they don't take advertising, they do have, you know, they had in-house list management. Most companies, if they rent their list, they usually have an outside list manager take care of that for them. But we had an in-house list management department, which is the first job that I had here. And it was a fascinating job to get as a first job because I think learning direct marketing from the list side of things is just a fantastic education. I mean, looking back, I didn't know it at the time because I didn't know a list broker from a stockbroker. But looking back, really learning marketing from the list side is basically learning marketing from, you know, who you're going to market to as opposed to being just an idea guy or just someone who sits in brainstorming meetings and figures out, you know, what's a good idea or what's a bad idea. But really, as opposed to figuring out where the markets are, what the demand is in those markets, and then finding products that people want as opposed to finding products that you're impressed with yourself or coming up with. So it was a very interesting early part of my career where, you know, renting, being in the list management business and, you know, dealing in that part of the business really got my feet wet in a way that, looking back, I think gives me a very, very unique perspective. And not to say that a lot of other people who come out of the list business or other media and then go into a more general marketing background are not as skilled as I am, but I think that most people who are in those areas because of, you know, it's very lucrative if you're in sales and a commission structure.
So you've got a good background. Can you tell us a little bit about how big Boardroom was back then and how big it is now?
Yeah, I mean, I got here in 81, the day Reagan was shot, was my first day at Boardroom. And Boardroom at that time was probably about 30 employees, 35 employees maybe, and we might have been doing maybe $5 million in revenue. We had maybe $8 million, I don't know. I don't really remember the exact number. We had at that time, the first newsletter we published was back in 1971, which was about 10 years old when I got here, was Boardroom Reports, which was a business newsletter geared to the, you know, the executive on how to run their business. Marty Elson, who started the company, had spent 10 years previous to starting Boardroom as the business manager of Commentary Magazine and was always very frustrated as a reader of business books and business magazines that none of them really told you how to run your business. They all had feature stories about IBM and you know, what's happening at AT&T, but Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, and the Wall Street Journal didn't do what he wanted, which was how do you run your business. So he launched Boardroom Reports in 71. Then he did a series of different business books with various people that he had met over the years and some tax subjects, some business subjects, none of them being that big. And then when I got to Boardroom in the early 80s, we had just started our second newsletter called Bottom Line Personal, which was Boardroom Reports, but the personal side of the executive. So then, and at the same time, we had a big selling book, finally, and the book was called The Book of Business Knowledge, and the book was, and this is why I'm giving you this background, because it really was the precursor to what the business became, because Book of Business Knowledge was basically Boardroom Reports' greatest hits. So basically the model of taking some of the best stuff from the newsletters, putting it into a big hardbound book, and selling it for $30 was a model that was fantastic, because a lot of people didn't want to be committed to a subscription newsletter, and yet there were a lot of people who bought books. So taking the same material, you know, this, you talk about, you know, the word repurposing editorial is in everybody's lexicon, you know, in the internet world. But back in 1980, 79, Marty had already figured out, now you say Marty invented hypertext before the internet. You know, and he understood that it wasn't repurposing was just a way of life. You have this great content, and some people want it in a subscription format, and some people want it in books. So Book of Business Knowledge sold over 100,000 copies or more, through direct mail only. And so a model was sort of born in with that. And then when Bottom Line Personal became our second big newsletter, obviously the same model held true, and then a book that was developed shortly after was called The Book of Inside Information, and that was Bottom Line's greatest hits. And that book ended up selling over 3 million copies in direct mail. So
the model being to publish content in the newsletter on a subscription basis, and then the breakthrough, and this happened in the 80s, was to take some of the content that was considered the best and then republish that as a book. And so the second revenue stream that worked really well.
That's correct. And I think that, I mean, and I'm going to give you some of the more recent history and the stuff that I brought to the table. You'll see it was a nice extension from that because clearly you're going to run out of editorial at some point. You only have so much that you can put in the books. And those had other books at the time too. We hired an author, for instance, to do a fantastic book on estate planning. And even that book, which is kind of vertical, because we had developed the database, this was the early days of database marketing, we weren't even doing modeling back then, but at least we had now a file of a few hundred thousand names that we could pick out the raisins in the cake and say, you know what, these are executives, these are high, income individuals. You know, if we could sell 30 or 40,000 copies of an estate planning book, we got ourselves a business there too. So we did an estate planning book, we did a tax planning book, so we were able to spin off more vertical subjects, that we're not going to sell as much as Book of Inside Information and Book of Business Knowledge, but they certainly were going to be able to mail to the same audience, and all of a sudden, you know, a book business was born out of both, I'll call it the horizontal nature of a Book of Inside Information and Greatest Hits from the newsletters, and then developing a more vertical book business that made perfect sense. Then we, you know, as the 80s...
How did you distribute the books?
Almost exclusively through direct mail. We were totally committed to direct mail at the time as the source to be able to get to what we call critical mass. You know, there was no way that we'd be able to sell a quantity of books like I just told you, you know, through space advertising. There was no way we were going to do it through TV because we didn't have the funds to do that. Plus, there was no model out there that said that this was going to work for TV. Direct mail had some history of selling books, obviously. Book of the Month Club and Macmillan was active back then. We did it in a way that was very interesting because we created direct mail, and this is probably the other, you know, early secret to the success, is that we created what I would call state-of-the-art direct mail. And by state-of-the-art is that we didn't just, you know, do formulaic, you know, order card, brochure, letter, but we created a whole technique. I mean, I call it fascinations, but a lot of people call it other things. But what it was the idea was that there was so many great tidbits in these books. I mean, our editorial was all about useful information. The newsletters were not feature magazines. They were newsletters. They were, you know, useful tidbits for either your business life or your personal life. And therefore, creating direct mail copy that talked about those tidbits with exciting, what we call fascinations, and then refer to a page number where you would find the answer to that fascination was a technique that was not invented by us. I mean, if you go...
You're using bullets.
Bullets, well, okay, there's a good name for it. We call them fascinations, but yes, you call them bullets. But you can go back to, you know, Ralph Ginsberg in the 60s used to use the technique of, you know, bullets with page numbers. There were a variety of other writers who were out there doing it, and we just mastered it. We had a couple of copywriters at the time who Marty had known from previous lives who were just fantastic at pulling out the nuggets out of a book and creating direct mail that just sung. I said direct mail that sings. It was... So to answer your question, it was all direct mail, basically. And to be able to sell those kinds of volumes in direct mail for one-shot books at the time, I don't want to say it was unprecedented, but the numbers were astounding.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. So you have subscribers on the newsletter, and you're out there acquiring lists, mailing to them, and using the lists in that way. You're then using that same acquired knowledge of those lists to then sell the books. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, list research, you know, is a universal. I mean, you know, anything... We did to sell our newsletters in direct mail, we used a lot of the same techniques to sell books. Different buyers, I mean, you're reaching into the barrel and pulling out different types of people, but selling books through direct mail and selling the newsletters through direct mail were, you know, there was certainly a lot of overlap in the techniques that we used, yes.
And what kind of size now is Boardroom Reports? Or Boardroom?
Well, it's really Boardroom Incorporated. Boardroom Reports doesn't even exist anymore as a newsletter. We've become, you know, as I say, after Bottom Line Personal, the next bit, well, we also had a tax newsletter at the time. I think actually tax hotline, we launched after Bottom Line Personal, and then after that we launched a health newsletter called Health Confidential, which became Bottom Line Health many years later, and fast forward, health became our biggest category. While Bottom Line Personal is still our biggest newsletter, overall at a category, the health category is by far our biggest. And, you know, we've done upwards of over $100 million in revenues, but, you know, some years, you know, anywhere between $70 million and $100 million, depending on how much we mail and which products are hot. We're very, very numbers-oriented in terms of we're not looking to just brag about what our revenues are. It's, you know, we're a traditional direct marketer, and every time we do a promotion, it has to pay out, and everything is measurable. So there's nothing we do that won't pay out. If it doesn't pay out, we stop doing it, as opposed to general advertisers who don't play that same game.
And so that's all offline direct mail. There's nothing telemarketing?
No. Well, today's a different story. So that 70 to 100 million includes a lot of other things. Obviously, by building this database as big as we have many, many books, and we have many newsletters now. Direct mail is still probably the lion's share, but we definitely do some telemarketing very, very selectively. That's not a big part of our business. But by selectively, I mean we basically only call existing customers and cross-sell them and upsell them to things that they'd be most interested in. We do a lot on the Internet, and our Internet model is one where we have right now two e-letters that one is in the health area, one is in the general consumer area. And the e-letters, the model on the internet for us is that the actual editorial product is free, but we embed ads for our other products in those e-letters so that it becomes a vehicle for selling, but it's, we deliver real editorial. So it's a content-driven e-business. And that's getting bigger and bigger every day.
What's some URLs we can look at?
What's that?
What would be some URLs that we can look at?
Somewhere else we can look at?
Oh, what are some URLs? What are the
URLs? Oh, bottomlinesecrets.com is our website. On that website, you can subscribe to either of the two e-letters. One is called Daily Health News, and the other is called Bottom Line Secrets. They're two different e-letters, which are free, so anybody can subscribe. And then also on that website, we have a store with all of our products, and we have, some information on the company and a variety of customer service things. And we're building right now an archive that will either be a pay archive or a membership archive. So we're working on that. But basically, our online business has been much more focused on email marketing as opposed to website marketing.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been building up, and how are you driving traffic to build up those lists?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do it. I mean, we do try to get as many email addresses as we can from people in direct mail. We offer on the internet, we have various affiliate deals where we'll offer free subscriptions, and we'll pay a bounty for every email address we can get for a new email subscriber. We have a program where existing customers who we have email addresses for, we give them an opportunity to subscribe to the free e-letters. Even though they're an offline customer, we try to convert them to an online customer. The problem with outside lists in the email world is that, the lists aren't very good. They're not that qualified. A lot of list owners in the e-world are trying to charge a CPM in the $200 to $300 per thousand range, and frankly, that would never pay out for us. I mean, we can't pay that for an offline list, and at least on an offline list, we know what the sales are. With an online, we're putting them on a free e-letter list, and it takes us, could take us 3-4 months to get our money back. So without a kind of a CPA deal, cost per acquisition, as opposed to a CPM deal on the list, it's very difficult to prospect to get new email subscribers in the traditional way that we knew from direct mail. But I'm seeing a lot of progress in the online world as a whole to figure out ways to do a lot more cost per acquisition that makes sense for both sides. And I'd like to see more of it, and that's kind of what we're pushing for.
The people listening to this are some of the best in the internet. They probably are, in fact, they are best in the internet in terms of driving commercial traffic on a CPA or a CPL possibly basis. So if you're interested in having any of them contact you, just, now's the time to say.
If they thought that there was some, I mean, my problem is that we have a lot of people contacting us all the time, and many of the, it sounds like your group is a lot more sophisticated, and they know more than a lot of the people who are knocking on my doors to date. But sure, we are always open to new ways to increase our email list of qualified subscribers who will buy our products from us.
Well, they do all kinds of stuff. I mean, as an example, your Alexa rank is 85,000. So that's actually fairly good. That means you're in the top 86,000 sites on the internet for traffic. So, there's some volume going to your site. One of the guys who's involved with this, he drives 300,000 signups a day to his site, and his Alexa rank is 120.
Oh, my God.
Like 2 billion impressions a month.
That's amazing.
So there's some guys driving a fair amount of
money. Yeah, no, that's very impressive.
It's a different crowd, but
everything with us is a direct marketing model. So, driving traffic and getting names is a great first step, but, I'm also interested in, everything's got to pay out, so.
Exactly. So, I agree completely. So let's move on now. I know that your expertise is in list management and so then acquiring new customers. I would just love to hear about how do you go about looking for a new list. I mean, where you start, how do you test it, how do you know it works, all that stuff.
Well, the business has changed a lot. I mean, I would say that, the first 10 years of my career, I would consider myself a list expert. I'm not saying I've become a list dunce, in the last 10 years, but I'm not as directly involved in the list business as I was. And frankly, the list business has changed a lot in terms of, quality names that are available. A lot, with postage increases and the cost of direct mail only going up, most, mailers who used to have, 100,000 new names a month now have, 50,000 new names a month. And that changes everything because it's a volume-driven business from a product standpoint for list brokers and managers. But as far as, I taught a lot of basic courses in direct mail, and the first thing that I teach in the list part of that is, really trying to understand what is the right list for your product. And there's a lot of different research that needs to get done. I mean, clearly if you have the volume to back it up to be able to work with a qualified list broker who can do the research for you, bring you the list that they think is right for your product, and then you analyze them based on who else has used the list, how many new names they're putting on on this list on a monthly or a quarterly basis. So you have to really analyze what they call the hotlines of the list. And I think a big thing for me has always been that, and there's a rule of thumb out there that says, you know, the looking at the promotion piece that got the name that got the name onto that list is probably the single biggest thing that will tell you if it's a fit for your product. For example, if I go to when I have a product, you know, Bottom Line Health, which is a health newsletter. If I, you'd say, okay, well, what would be a great list for that? Well, the Harvard Medical School health letter should be a great list for Bottom Line Health. Well, I'll tell you that the Harvard Medical School health letter list doesn't work for Bottom Line Health. Why? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. One is that Bottom Line Health happens to be more integrated medicine, whereas the Harvard health letter is more just traditional, with traditional and alternative. In addition, even more important, is that the control package, or what Harvard Medical, and this is not a criticism of Harvard Medical, by the way, they have a great newsletter, and even I know the marketing people there, so maybe I shouldn't even, you know, single that out, because it's a fine list, it just doesn't work for us. But I'm using it for, it's a very good example, because their control package that they use to get new customers is a number 10 envelope. It's not very, called fascination driven. And therefore, it's a whole different approach. And the kind of person that would subscribe to a package like that is going to be very different than our package, which our control package for Bottom Line Health is an 8.5 by 11 magalog, meaning that it's a self-mailer 16-page promotion piece with a lot of color and a lot of photographs and a lot of big headlines and a lot of hyperbole that we can back up, of course. And it's not, I'll call it a direct fit, so that the kind of promotion that we're doing, the average person would look at those two lists and say they don't work because they're not synergistic, because Harvard is traditional health and Bottom Line Health is integrated health. And I'd say to them, that may be one of the reasons. I would maintain, though, that it's even more important that if Harvard was using a format and an approach to get new customers like we were, there'd probably be a better chance of that list working for us, even though it's only traditional medicine. So that's the kind of thing. That, to me, that's advanced list selection. I cut right to the chase. I skipped over all the basics of list selection and went to something that's a fairly advanced concept.
No. What's interesting about that is that, because that may tie over to behavioral targeting for us. One of the things that I don't see in targeting on the web right now is it's not easy to find out, well, okay, we've got profiles of users that have done a specific thing or signed in a specific offer, but we don't get to see landing pages that cause them to sign in.
Or subject lines and, you know, what landed in their inbox that got their attention.
And what you're saying is that in your experience in offline direct mail, and obviously there's a fair amount of volume behind it given the revenue you guys are doing, that's in fact extremely important predictor of what's going to happen. Are you suggesting that's more important than other predictors such as demographics?
I don't want to say more. I think it's dangerous to say more. I think, you know, when we look at list selection, it's a package deal. In fact, I developed a worksheet way back when I was doing list selection as, you know, more of my full-time job, and we developed a worksheet that basically asked a ton of different questions. So someone recommended a list to me, and I would ask all of these questions. I'd say, what is the kind of mailing piece that got the names? Then I would find out who else has used the list. Then I would find out what the demographics are to see if that's a fit. I would take a look at, you know, what the subject matter is, if it was a newsletter, for instance, so the editorial content. Then I would even do things like, you know, what's the price? You know, is it a $30 newsletter or is it a $100 newsletter? Big difference. How did they sell it? Did they sell it with a bill me offer or cash with order? Much bigger difference between those two. So I can't say that one thing is more than another, but I will say that the promotion that got the name is as important as any one single thing in many, many cases. I will tell you that there are lists out there that use our exact, you know, very similar promotions to us, but, you know, if it's for, you know, auto supplies, forget about it. And it could be for auto supplies, but it could also be our demographic. The auto supplies for people over 60, it's still, the list probably won't work because the subject matter is just too far away. But it's a real critical factor. But I think the point that I'd like to make for your listeners and your readers is that it's a snapshot. You know, a list universe is not, see, there are no unique names. There are only unique lists. So what makes that list, that compilation of those names in that grouping, what are the things that make them different than people who are in the same demographic? What makes the subscribers to Money Magazine different than the subscribers to Smart Money Magazine? Now, there may not be a lot of differences in how the list performs, but there are incredible aspects. If Money Magazine, you know, has moved their editorial to, you know, a 30-plus, that's important, a 35-year-old, and Smart Money is geared to the 55-plus. That demographic is very important. But I maintain that if Smart Money went to a Magalog format from a number 10 format, that's going to change the behavior of the names on the list much more.
Right.
So, you know, I can't give you that. I can't give you a quick soundbite that says, you know, one thing is the most important. But I think the most important thing to know is that list selection has a lot of science to it. It really does.
Fair enough. And so when you're conducting a test, what for you is a valid test?
Well, when we test creative panels in direct mail, we're doing 25,000 name panels. When we're testing a list, usually you can test in quantities. The rule of thumb is 5,000 names if you want to see if a list is going to work or not. The rule of thumb that was always used by one of my mentors, who was a direct mail pioneer, Dick Benson, he used to always say you want to back into a number, because if your response rate's based on what response rate you generally get, you want to get about 100 net orders to kind of have a group of people that tells you that I learned something. So the reason I think why I'm trying to back into why I don't know why 5,000 became the number, but if you mailed 5,000 names and got a 1% response, that would be 50 orders. On a soft offer, on a bill mail offer, you probably can get as much as 2% response, so that would give you 100 orders. I think that's where a lot of the 5,000 came from. I find that because we have a bill mail offer, I want to also see how many net subscribers or net buyers I get at a particular panel, and to do that, I want to do 5 times the amount because I may only get 20% payup, 25% payup, depending on if it's a newsletter. On books, I get 60 or 70% payup. But I want to have enough net orders to be able to read the test. So to answer your question, you said, how many names do you test? It's really, you kind of back in and say, how many responses do I need to make this a valid measurement and something that I can roll out to with confidence?
Yeah, no, I get that. And so what you're saying is 100 orders is the number that you aim for, and you'll back that out to how many would likely generate 100 orders.
100 net orders, yeah. Now, and that's on the low end. I mean, these days, you know, I will say that, you know, I wouldn't mind having 150 or 200, but, you know, sometimes it gets costly. And direct mail has gotten incredibly expensive. I mean, postage just went up again, you know, in a big way. So, I mean, I think the interesting thing when I think about offline versus online, you know, the good news and the bad news. I mean, the good news about online, of course, is, you know, how cheap it is to test. The bad news about online is how cheap it is to test, because, you know, the cheapness of the testing means that everybody can be in business, which means you've got a much crowded, the inboxes are more crowded. The ability to get response rates that make any kind of statistical significance are much harder to get. And frankly, you know, I've been over the years frustrated with our online testing, and I have much more confidence still on our offline testing in terms of creative, in terms of everything that we do, even to the tune of, you know, finding out what the best package is to go then use for the online version. I'd rather test offline if I can. It's much expensive, but I feel like I can hang my hat on that data much better.
Mm. Well, you're an offline company. That's in your genes. And some
it is, but, you know, I will tell you that everything that we do offline, we transfer it to online. So, for instance, the best direct mail packages we have, we then create online versions of those direct mail packages. And we don't shorten them. They're really long still. If they're 16 pages offline, they're going to be 16 pages online. And that works the best. And so it's rare that we make changes because we think online people are going to be different and that they actually beat what the offline best package was. So I go back to, you know, people's behavior, and a lot of that doesn't change. And the emotions that you need in promotion copy, there are still many, many universals, as we know.
One of the guys listening to this call is doing 60 million a year online, just 100% online, no offline, and that's all just internet sales. So there may be some differences that maybe don't translate, which our guys would have a tough time unless they pick it up from someone like you.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, you never want to say, you know, if you make blanket statements about online and offline. I have one situation now which is very interesting. One of my best direct mail packages for our health newsletter had beaten the previous control by a significant margin, and the previous control was a 6x9 envelope. The current control is one of these 16-page Magalogs off mailers. And interestingly, when we tested the new, you know, the version of the 6x9 that was the online, we had an online version, it was one of the few times where I took a 16-page new control that won significantly in the offline world, put that online, and it did not beat the previous control, the 6x9. That's the exception, not the rule. But so that's one of the few times where my online control now is actually a previous offline control that was beaten handily.
Hmm.
It happens, you know, and that's the beauty of direct marketing is that, and that's why direct marketing, you know, anybody who says online marketing is not direct marketing is nuts. You know, it's just as measurable, if not more, and you get immediate gratification. You don't have to wait for the postal service to deliver it, assuming your emails get delivered.
I think we probably have more deliverability problems than you, but
you have more deliverability, but you certainly get your response rates faster and you get results faster, so you can move on things, you can test things faster. But again, my confidence level, because we're an offline company to start, I don't have the same kind of confidence that probably some of your CEOs do.
We can have answers back on a test in 1 hour.
Exactly. And we do too. I mean, our online business is run like that. But that's not what we grew up with, so we have both sides of that.
So I've actually got some quotes from an interview that I heard of you before on my wall, and I found some of the stuff you're talking around split testing fascinating. You talk about the control is your enemy and don't have time. What are the elements that when you're making tests, what are the elements that you guys aim to test first?
That's a good question. I mean, the Don't Make Tiny Tests was from Gordon Grossman, who was one of our consultants. Because in our early days of Direct Mail, if you read some of the classic Direct Mail books, they'll tell you, you have a sales letter, you change it from white to blue, or you change the envelope from white to blue, and you can get a 15% lift. And I'm not saying that those people weren't lying, but frankly, with the cost of Direct Mail as it is today, I'm not making that test, anymore. I mean, maybe I did it one time.
There's a lot of people on the internet, in the sort of the lower level internet marketing circles, that still spend quite a bit of time testing colors.
Well, you know what? On the internet, though, it doesn't cost you as much.
The big guys don't, but it's the little guys spend time testing stuff like that. The three things that I found in my experience in working with clients that have make the biggest difference is the headline, the offer, and the price.
And not necessarily in that order, depending on which of our products. Once we find sweet spot on price, it's very hard to find a new price point for the same product. Getting to that sweet spot of price is a lot. There's a lot of testing that goes into that. The offer, we're always playing with that. Adding premiums, taking premiums away, combining premiums. Premiums is a big one for us. I mean, discounts, not as much. In the premium area, you have free bonuses. You have gross and net premiums. There's a lot of things you can do there. And then headlines, we have had some breakthrough results with certainly a lot of our self-mailers, the idea of changing covers of a self-mailer, which is in the realm of changing headlines. We've seen some dramatic results there too. But when you say don't make tiny tests, this idea of, changing color on a particular page or changing font sizes or, moving a picture from the left to the right and adding a photo here or there. In the olden days, when direct mail was a lot cheaper, we could afford to do stuff like that. I have to believe we didn't get a lot of breakthroughs then either. And I think the beauty of it is the cost has now prevented us from making stupid tests, or tiny tests, as I call them. And
so
we do want to test bigger things.
So what are, you thinking, what are the 5 or 10 things you care about testing now?
Okay, so you mentioned headlines, covers, outer envelopes, price, offer, premiums, working more timely. I mean, timeliness is a tough thing to test because when gas prices are going through the roof and you do a cover that talks about gas prices and it stays the control for a year, who knows where gas prices are going to be in a year. On the other hand, a lot of mailers, like to do the timeliness stuff, so that it is certainly worth testing. I think figuring out ways to create more perceived value, and there's a lot of ways to do that, whether it's adding a premium that's a lot bigger, taking a premium and breaking it apart into, from one big book into 50 special reports, things like that. What are some of the other things you like to test? The biggest breakthroughs you normally get too is if you're working with the best copywriters in the world or in the country, once you put yourself in the hands of a great copywriter, it's sort of like not just a fresh pair of eyes looking at the current controls as your enemy. Control's your enemy. You got a world-class copywriter looking at that control, understanding why it's working, and they understand what they have to do to beat it. And I think that the biggest breakthroughs do come with an A-plus copywriter coming up with a completely new approach. And so the unique selling proposition and underlying things, now you're not testing elements anymore, but you're testing a whole new concept. And frankly, our biggest breakthroughs are usually that. Another thing we'll test a lot of is...
Before you go on, actually a really interesting point. So you'll find an A-plus copywriter. I mean, where would we find one of those guys, and then how much would we pay someone like that?
Well, most of them won't work for new clients too quickly because of what they charge and what they expect to be paid. The best copywriters in the country, there's a retired copywriter. I don't want to mention names on this call, but I'll mention one who's retired, probably one of the best copywriters of all time by the name of Gary Bensavenga. And Gary Bensavenga would charge anywhere from, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 up front, and then he would get a mailing royalty so that a lot of those writers would get upwards of $50 per thousand or 5 cents per piece mailed. No matter how long the piece was in control, and they would get a royalty on every piece you nailed with their copy on it. Now, that's on the very, I give you the highest end possible, to scare your folks off the most, but there are writers who are up and coming who might charge less than that, who are real.
That's a good case. I mean, I know a lot about Gary Bensavenga. I'm on his list, and he's got mixed some interesting points. So you're suggesting your point of view as in this case is in our terminology, you're an advertiser. So as a guy who's running an offer and you want a higher conversion rate, you're saying that the best approaches for you have come when you've brought in an outside advertiser, paid them $30,000 to $50,000 plus a percentage of revenue generated. That's been what's been the biggest breakthrough for you. Is that correct?
I would say advertiser. I say copywriter. You said hire an advertiser.
In our terminology, you're an advertiser on the internet terminology.
Okay, so I'm an advertiser and I'm hiring, but I'm hiring a copywriter.
You're hiring a copywriter to write your advertising for you.
Right. Overall, we've had more breakthroughs there than anywhere else. Format is a big one I didn't mention either. You know, going from a number 10 package to an oversized Magalog or tabloid or Bookalog, as they call them, there are a lot of different, we've had some huge breakthroughs with format changes, but usually, the format coincides with copy changes as well.
That is really interesting. that is just really interesting. And that's because some of the guys who do the most volume on the internet, they do some testing, but they don't even do that much split testing, let alone bringing in outside copywriters to have a look at
it. Oh, gosh. Then, I would think that would hold true with copywriter, with online as well as offline. The interesting thing, though, is that with all the other things that I mentioned that we like to test, maybe you get a new copywriter, and in one fell swoop, you get a 40% lift or a 30% lift. But you know what? I always have the expression. What do they call the guy who or woman who graduates last at Harvard Medical School?
They call him doctor.
Doctor, absolutely. So there's a real need to keep doing what we call tweaks. And it sounds like you're not making any headway. But we get a lot of 10, 15, 20% lifts from premiums and headlines and all the things that it sounds like your guys are doing. And I don't want to minimize that. That stuff's really important. But yeah, I mean, I think getting a fresh look and a completely new selling proposition is certainly a way to get a huge breakthrough.
Yeah, all right. And I mean, these are sort of breakthroughs that have generated millions and millions of dollars. I mean, these are products that you're driving at least $10 million a year in revenue through in offline direct now. Is that correct?
Not all of them, but yeah, a lot of them, sure. Hmm. I mean, not every product is. They're all doctors, but some are brain surgeons.
Sure. you raised some really interesting stuff in the beginning where you talked about books, and effectively you're talking about backends. And so your front end, as I understand it, would be your newsletters, which people pay a monthly fee to receive. Would it be possible to talk a little bit about some of the backends behind those newsletters?
Well, I mean, the backend of the newsletters, the biggest thing is renewals. The beauty of any subscription business is, if the editorial is good, and it's fun. One of the great expressions that my mentor Dick Benson used to say is, it took us marketers off the hook. It's editors sell renewals, marketers don't. So, I can bring them in the door and I do all this great stuff with the great copywriters and the great promotion pieces. But ultimately, if people aren't going to stick around, that's one way. There are a lot of businesses that don't have a renewal business, but they usually have advertising. So that you just have to keep replacing the people that fall off the file. In our business, because we don't have advertising, it's critical to have, we move our renewal point 1 or 2 points. It's a make or break sometimes. And a lot of that is the editorial product. I can't, if you're a subscriber for 9 months and I'm trying to renew you and you're not happy with publication, I don't know what I can do to get you to re-up. So, that's where editorial and marketing have to work together a little bit more. Being in a smaller company like ours and being a newsletter as opposed to a magazine doesn't have to worry about advertisers. I think we can have a little less separation of church and state, and it makes our business not simpler, but certainly more synergistic on both the editorial and marketing side. So, renewals to me is the ultimate back end for a newsletter business. Now, the book business, as I said, the early book business for us was newsletters' greatest hits, but you run out of stuff. And one of the real epiphanies that I had through one of my consultants, Gordon Grossman, he had a quote to me one day, and he called me up and he said, "Your book business is doing great, but you only have a few titles that are working really well because your best titles are the ones that are your greatest hits books. So what makes you think that every one of your books has to be your own editorial stuff?" And I said, "It's a good point. What do I, so then I took that piece of information and I literally, took one of my marketing people one night. We went to Barnes & Noble, to the bookstore. We took a hand truck, we took a hand truck from the storeroom. I asked if I could borrow a hand truck. And we went to every part of the store that had a category that was an element of our database, meaning people on our database of interest areas. So I went to the text area, I went to the health area, I went to the business area, I went to the consumer information area, I went to the retirement area, the obviously finance and money management area, and I think we bought that night, 50 or 60 different books off the shelf. Soft covers, hard covers, most of them had quite a bit of dust on them because, as you know, most authors get paid in advance for a book and they never see a dollar of royalty because once the book is released and it has a little fanfare, it sits on the shelf and you sell a few here and a few there. And what I did was I started looking at all of these books and started figuring out which of these books would make for a good direct mail book. What is a good direct mail book? From the Boardroom perspective, it was a book that we could pull fascinations out of. So I was going to use the same philosophy that I used in our newsletter business becoming a book business to take books that already existed and sort of, you know, reverse the funnel and decide which books might have a flair for, or at least a better chance of selling in direct mail. And then I weeded those down, and then I started sending a few of those titles to some of our best copywriters and said, what do you think? Could you write one of your, you know, whiz-bang packages for one of these? And basically a whole new part of our book business was born. And we now have a whole bunch of titles that were former trade books that may or may not have sold well, and well, again, is relative. I mean, if you talk to a trade publisher and they tell you they sell 50,000 books, I think they'll tell you that was a pretty big seller. Meanwhile, if we don't sell, you know, 100,000 a year in direct mail, given the way we do direct mail, I won't say it's a failure, but it's not a book we're probably going to stay with for very long. So we've had a lot of trade publishers who've been very, very happy with their royalties on this.
So you're taking existing books. So you went to the bookstore and took existing books and then weeded those down until you had a set of books that you wanted to sell, or did you rewrite those and then they became your books?
Well, what we did was we didn't rewrite them. I mean, the idea was to try to make it as turnkey as we could because, you know, and nothing is, we have another expression here, nothing is turnkey. But what we did was we took like a book that was a trade book, like a big soft cover, and we might have either taken some, we might have taken some stuff out, we might have added some stuff in, we always put a hardcover on it. And then the thing that we do best is add premiums. So we create other books so that even if, let's say the book is sitting on, say it was a hardcover book in the trade. So it's a hardcover health book sitting on the shelf in Barnes & Noble at $29.95. We take the same book, let's say it's, better yet, it's sitting on the shelf at Barnes & Noble at $19.95. We take the same book, we add some material to it, we update it, we put Bottomline's logo on it since it's going out a lot to our database, we put a hardcover on it, we put a different cover, we add material through premiums that you can't get anywhere else. I mean, you know, they're worth something, although they're free bonuses, and now you've got a book and a package that you could sell for $29 instead of $19 or, you know, $29 instead of $24 or whatever. So The problem is you do need a little bigger margin because direct mail is expensive. So we're finding that it's very hard to get the margins unless we can get to $29. So, but I'm giving you way too much detail, I think, here.
This is what we want. So getting the price up and then you negotiate the royalties down, that gave you enough room to make it work on direct mail.
Yeah, I didn't have to negotiate the royalties down. I just had to negotiate a fair royalty. It's not so much the royalty that would hold us back. It would be the production cost of the book. It's the bad debt. I mean, when you do direct mail for a book and you're offering it as a free trial, you know, you have to do a lot of bad debt screening and you know, you're going to have 30% of the people maybe that aren't going to pay you. So that means you're sending out 100% of the books, you're only getting paid on 70. The 30% of books that you've sent out, that's the real cost, goes right to the bottom line. So there's a lot of other things involved in the risk-reward in the direct mail world. But the key here was, the epiphany was, you know, you have the machinery to develop, to do direct mail. You know the formula. It doesn't necessarily just have to be greatest hits of your own books. And, you know, we're good at it. So we were able to, you know, find a lot of books that we found some great partners.
And you just stayed with books. You didn't try anything else?
On the internet, we're trying, like, there you can do maybe, you know, special reports, which to me is just shorter books, and charge a low price point. And that's something we're trying more and more of. Because the promotion costs so much less.
It's fascinating what you talk about because it's so similar to a lot of the models people are using actively on the net, where the front end is some kind of an e-book and putting people into a continuity program which is built around the e-book. So there's the monthly subscription exactly like you have in a newsletter. And then to that same list, other offers or related offers are sent, which are related affiliate products, which then the advertiser keeps the commission for.
I see the analogy.
Very interesting. All right, anything you want to add in closing?
No, I mean, I got into some real detail there probably a fraction of what we do, but I think that, you know, I think what's interesting as we were talking, and you just kind of summed it up well, that, you know, online, offline, yeah, I mean, it's very, very different, and the models are different, and the economics are different, and all that, but I think what we're always talking about is direct marketing, and which means that everything is testable, everything is measurable. I think that, you know, anybody who's working on the internet, I think it's easier to get sloppy on the internet, because everything is so cheap to do. But, and, you know, so you won't lose a lot of money, but you're certainly going to waste a lot of time, and you're also going to clutter up people's inboxes. I mean, there's another theory in direct mail, and I don't know if this is true in online, because I haven't explored it enough, but there's a theory that says every time you send something to someone, you may reduce the response to something else. And it's a concept in direct mail called context strategy. So that if in the ideal world, if I had 12 products, if you're on my customer list, you're a subscriber to one of my newsletters, and I've got now 12 more products I want to sell you, we know that there's probably an ideal order to send you those products, 1 to 12, and an interval of when to send them to you.
Right.
Do we ever get there? Absolutely not. I mean, I don't know any direct marketer. If they tell you they know how to do that, they're full of it. They might, though, have done enough testing to start figuring out a bunch of patterns, that I know the three best of the 12. I know that I better get those three offers to you in the first 6 months of when you're on my file, because then you're going to fall off, and that's what can maximize my income. And I'm just wondering if online, because people have gotten so, my word is sloppy, but I don't mean to criticize anybody, except for the fact that I look at my inbox every day and I see the same crap from the same people over and over again without any regard for why they're sending me that at that particular time or in what order. And I think the direct mail cost has disciplined the direct mail people in a way that I think if the internet folks were disciplined in the same way, there might be a little higher response rate. On the other hand, it doesn't really matter since it's so cheap anyway. And I just asked that question.
Well, and here's some thoughts on it. Have you heard of the book called Drilling Down by, I think it's Jim Rohn?
I have heard of that book. I've not read it.
Jim Novo. Some great stuff there in applying. He worked with the Home Shopping Network and applying limits to things. So you've had a buyer that's come in. What's the limit when they're considered no longer a buyer? That's obviously a big question. But at what point do they stop responding? And he puts triggers on things, and they determine then what those limits are, and then try to send their customers down a funnel. We're starting to do that stuff online. It's also being used for targeting as well. So a lot of
do you think that he's come up with conclusions that are really actionable, or that they're just theories?
They seem pretty actionable in the book, but
okay.
I have experience with them. It is a very good book.
I would definitely get it. I'm always open to this type of thing. I think that I remember one of my first years in the business. This was in the early 1980s. I was pitching our list to a mailer of direct mail books, and I said, you know, let's do a list exchange. I'll mail your list, you'll mail mine. And the response I got was, well, we're really careful about how many exchanges we do, because we calculated, this is in, 1982, we calculated what we think, I don't think they drilled down, what they think the average person will buy on books in a particular year. And therefore, we can't rent to this many people, because once we get to that limit, they won't buy any more books from us. Now, to me, that's a theory that has no founding in anything.
Right.
Because if you give somebody a great offer at a great price, I don't care how much you tried to sell them before, you can still sell them something else. But I do believe that there is optimal contact strategies that can be employed that can maximize income in the shortest amount of time. And there are a lot of models. I mean, we do lifetime value models all the time of our customers on our database, and I can't say that they are 100% accurate, but I do know that they're actionable because we test them against each other. You know, we test new customer comes in on this offer, and then we test off the next offer we send them, it's A versus B, which one responded better, and at this time interval, and then we know that, you know, for that type of customer with that profile, we should be going in this order with this product line. So
on a related question then, have you guys ever done any testing with Taguchi or design experiments?
No.
Fair enough. It's an area that I experimented with and spent about a year or so on and came to the conclusion that it doesn't work very well.
So there you go. You just saved me all that money. Well, that's something I think I can go buy a book now because of you.
the reason I ask is because the Jim Nova stuff, I'd heard his stuff works. I heard the Taguchi stuff works as well, but it never worked reliably for me.
Mm-hmm.
Drilling down stuff looks as intriguing to me as Taguchi did, but I haven't tested. So.
Right, that sounds good. I asked that question, but I will look at it. I think that just like in database marketing, you know, there are a lot of people that claim that they can calculate the lifetime value of a customer to the penny, and I have not seen any one model that, you know, I would trust my life on. But there's a lot of good stuff out there, and, you know, it's only going to get better, as we both know. I mean, it's, you know, there's only going to be more data, more technology, more ability. But you know what? I go back to another study, and I'm going back to my mentors of 20 years ago, that, you know, people are still people, and human behavior is still human behavior. And one of the best books that I would ever recommend was a book that was written in 1966 that we reprinted called Breakthrough Advertising by Gene Schwartz.
Yeah.
And that book is, you know, that's about human behavior, and that hasn't changed.
Actually, and anybody listening on this call, you want to pick that up. You guys probably haven't heard of this one. Eugene Schwartz, Breakthrough Advertising. It is one of my all-time favorite books as well, particularly the chapters on the sophistication of markets. It's fascinating.
Yes.
And Boardroom, guys that published it, and it's a really, really good book.
Yeah, the book was out of print. We saw it on eBay for $950. Somebody paid $950 for an out-of-print copy. So I went to Gene's widow. Gene was actually one of those early fascination writers, by the way. And Gene was known for, basically, he didn't write books per se, but he did, because what he would do is he would go to an author and he would get all their material, and then he would pull from their material what he wanted to put in the book, because it was the stuff he could write the best fascinations for. He basically wrote a book kind of backwards, starting with the direct mail, and then built the book based on what he could write the best copy for, which is, to me, basically underlines a lot of the things that I was talking about in terms of creative development. But anyway, the thing about that book is that, so we went out of print, and we saw it on eBay for $950, and we had once reprinted it in a small volume well after 1966, probably in the mid-1980s. And we printed, I don't know, a few hundred copies, and then those went out of print. And so I went to Gene's Will, Barbara, and I said, you know, I'd like to get Gene's book back in circulation. I don't think people should be paying $950 for it. And she agreed, and that's when we republished it, and we have a new version, which, you know, Marty Edelson wrote a foreword for. We're charging, I think, a very reasonable price of $95 for it, and that is available on our website. On the if you go to the store page or the Buy It Now tab or whatever it is, it has a list of all of our books, and it includes that book, includes Gordon Grossman, who wrote a fairly new book, Confessions of a Direct Mail Guy, and also we have Dick Benson's book in there, Secrets of Successful Direct Mail. So we're kind of republishing classics as sort of a hobby. I mean, we're not making a lot of money on these books, believe me. But we felt that these books really needed to still be in print. And I'm really glad to hear that you've read Gene's book and that you're a fan of it. That tells me a lot about you, Adrian. Good stuff.
Well, I think I read the other ones as well, but the one that really impacted me was the Eugene Schwartz one. But just when I saw the sophistication of markets and how they evolve over time, that was a real light bulb moment for me.
Well, I tell you, the book was written in 1966, and we haven't changed a word, so.
Very good. Well, thank you. Let's leave it there, and again, thank you for spending time with us.
All right, great. Thanks, Adrian.